My name is Dot Nichterlang, and I've been running a series of discussions, and I emphasized the word discussion last week and this week, on the sociological perspective on the roles and relationships of men and women in American society. Tonight, the basic topic, which was chosen by last week's group when I gave them a list of what would you like to do if you were going to be here next week. This was one of the ones they said. This is on sex and marriage. It is a bit presumptuous for anyone in this day and age to get up in front of any group of anybody over the age of about 11 and try to talk about sex. Everyone knows an awful lot about it, and we hear about it all the time. I have taught classes in marriage and the family and have done some counseling with young people, both adolescents and young adults, and I've done a little bit of marriage counseling as well, kind of on the side. And I always feel I don't know enough about what I'm talking about either. This is not intended to be a heavy information session. It is really my purpose to present a few of the sociological insights about sex and marriage, which are not always widely disseminated in our culture, and to begin a discussion which will then go in whichever direction you would like it to go. We have quite a heterogeneous group here, and you know, we could spend all week, all summer, all year talking about this topic. So 1 hour is really just intended to get some thoughts started and give you a bit of an opportunity to share some of your own insights into this whole situation. There are two underlying principles to begin with. One is that the terms male and female are biological terms. Masculine and feminine are social terms, which are based on the biological but are not the same thing. And it is important to keep these separate in our minds as well as in our terminology. And the second principle is that all societies have some means for governing or and regulating sex and marriage. In North America right now, it sometimes seems as though it's anything goes, but that is very definitely not the case. We are not subject to total free choice in the partners that we choose for sex or for marriage. There are some strict regulations in law and also in custom, in our family structures, in church bodies, and so on, that that do regulate at least some of our attitudes and behaviors. Okay. The sociologist's perspective is to look always at the social context in which people's ideas and attitudes develop, and to always examine behavior within, within that kind of a framework. American society, North American society, is more complex than many, partly because we have the heritage of many nationalities and cultures within our one society. We draw on these ideas and patterns which are widely divergent from one another. So we don't have just one pattern that we all fit into. And it is also partly complex because we do have advanced communication and technology, and so we know a lot more about what everybody else thinks and does. This means that we have to construct our own sets of values rather than simply absorbing a single set like everyone else around us, which would be the case in a much more homogeneous society. Sex ethics can be a problem in our culture because we are constantly subjected to mixed messages. On the one hand, we are supposed to get the idea that sex is a totally natural aspect of life, and that's why it's around us all the time. We hear and read about it in a variety of forms. In fact, we can hardly ever forget about sex in our culture. But on the other hand, We are very much aware of a myriad of taboos and prohibitions surrounding the whole business. It is not a topic that is easily discussed, even though we hear about it and we hear some types of discussion easily. Indeed, we are more likely to learn the no-nos than the yeses. So it is no wonder that we can become almost schizoid about what some have called the most personal part of ourselves. And it is especially difficult in our society because young people become physiologically mature long before they are psychologically or economically independent. Children are physiologically capable of becoming parents. And more of them seem to be doing that. And so the sad fact is that we have growing social problems having to do with the whole topic of sex and marriage. Another difficulty is the fact that males and females develop somewhat differently, and our assumptions sometimes are that we're more or less alike. There are always individual exceptions, of course, but on the average, girls are physically mature earlier than boys are. However, their sexual responsiveness tends to lag far behind males, and it also takes different forms. Boys focus much more intensely on genital stimulation than do girls. As a matter of fact, it sometimes seems in early adolescence that boys don't think about anything else, which leads many young girls to the conclusion that, quote, boys only want one thing. And sometimes that message is reinforced so vividly in young people that that idea stays, sometimes forever, and can cause serious problems among adults. Also, the male model is the prevailing one in our culture, as it is in so many areas. The culture tells us that, of course, we are all very sexy creatures. But interpreting what that means is different for males and females. Many, if not most, young females simply do not experience the same sort of erotic sensations that young males do. And then they sometimes end up feeling that they ought to be feeling the way the culture is telling them they ought to feel. But for females, the emotional aspects are much more significant than they appear to be for young males. Which leads to another old saying, boys play at love in order to get sex, and girls play at sex in order to get love. They're kind of on different tracks. And again, there are individual variances from this, but this seems to be the typical kind of trend. And there are other misconceptions about developmental paths that males and females take. I'll draw one of them out for you. Now, I don't know anything about most of you in this room. This might all be very well understood by you, but apparently in our culture it is not so widely understood as perhaps it ought to be. Now, this has to do with the responsiveness to sexual stimulation, the difference between males and females. And again, this is an overall generalization. Doesn't fit every individual. But in general, young males tend to hit a peak of sexual responsiveness in late teens, early 20s, and then very gradually that tapers off. Whereas females tend, now this is sexual responsiveness to stimulation. Females, there he goes, much more gradually hit some sort of a peak, and exactly where it comes is open for debate. But then when they hit it, they tend to stay at the same level that they were. as Dan Erlander said yesterday in his last day, that's drawn to scale. Well, according to that, if that's true, and a great many researchers say it is, if sex were all that mattered in marriage, 40-year-old women ought to marry 20-year-old men. Now, I don't happen to know of any satisfactory cross-cultural data which says one way or another whether this kind of developmental pattern is true universally. This isn't my major area of study, and so it's not something that I have really gone looking for, you know, to find out if those studies exist. Maybe some of you know. But in our society, the theory is that this is the kind of pattern that tends to be true. Now, if the males and females in our society do not understand that this tends to be the true pattern, you can see what kind of misconceptions and misunderstandings can develop. Okay. Anybody want to say anything about this?
Well, you mentioned the fact that there are other cultures might have different curves. That suggests that this is not a biologically stimulated chart.
It isn't if other cultures have a different pattern, but I don't know if they do or not, is what I'm trying to say.
I don't suspect it does, would you?
Pardon me?
I wouldn't suspect it isn't culturally oriented.
I don't know. Culture certainly has something to do with it, but I don't know. Any comments?
My understanding is the androgens that drive the sexual responsiveness, and with women, when they approach menopause or after menopause, their estrogens are dropping, so the androgens they have from their adrenal glands are still high, and that's why they continue mm-hmm. with having a high sex interest.
And those are all the chemicals in your brain that are working
out. In your hormone.
In your hormone, but the androgens are in your
androgens are in your adrenal glands.
Okay, but aren't they also one of the five chemicals that are in your brain cells? No, there's another one. It's very similar to that. It has to do with sex in your brain, too.
Well, whatever. Now, that's not what our culture tells us is happening, though, is it?
No.
And so we tend to grow up thinking that we're more or less on similar paths, that maybe guys act hornier than girls do from an early age, but that in general, you know, we're sort of getting to the same place about the same time. And if a couple marries with him feeling that women in general probably feel like he does, and he just happens to have the bad luck to be hooked up with someone who is weird or frigid or whatever, and if she feels that men in general are more or less like women are, but that she just happens to be hooked up with someone who's oversexed or whatever, it's very difficult for them to even begin communicating about the problem that they have, because, you know, they're not on the same wavelength about it. They don't have the same fundamental understanding of what's going on. It's easier to communicate with someone when you think he or she is just misunderstanding something. You can convince him or her of what the situation ought to be. But when you think that basically there's something wrong there, then it's not so easy. And that is complicated by the fact that males and females tend to communicate in different styles, particularly about matters having to do with love, sex, etc. And again, there are individual differences, but the male pattern of communication tends to be much more instrumental. And so you'll have the guy's attitude being, okay, we got a problem, let's go to bed together and work it out. Whereas the female's communication tends to be much more verbal, expressive, and her problem solving is, let's talk it through and work it out and then go to bed together.
Okay? That's so, too general for me. I don't believe that that's, those generalities are 100%. It's just those are overgeneralizations.
Well, I think what I was trying to say is that that is a pattern.
It is one pattern. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, okay, how would you, would you feel?
There are men who are able to talk about their feelings, and
absolutely,
there are women as well who are not able to. It's not, at least in my experience, it's not 100% clear cut one way or the other.
Yeah, but percentage-wise, the numbers that are able to do that.
Yes, but it's not 100%.
That's what you're saying. That's what you're saying.
You're right.
Even if it's the other way around, it is difficult often for a man and a woman to come to some mutual understanding of what's happening in their own situation because, and this is the further complication, we get from the culture the message of how the sexes are to relate to one another. And so we're comparing our own specific experience with some sort of an idealized pattern, and we don't have very good ways of finding out whether our individual experience is anything like the reality. Okay. Now, anybody have any good clues as to how we can begin to solve this sort of problem in our society? Do we need more information? Do we need better counseling? Do we have to educate children better? Yeah.
Two things that helped me very much. One was reading the book Games People Play by Eric Byrne, and he had a big section in there on marital games. And then I might add that prolonged my first marriage by at least 6 years. And then second one was I got smart and went to Marriage Encounter Weekend. Mm-hmm. And that really...
And what Marriage Encounter Weekends do is you learn a communication skill of writing love letters to each other. And they build it up to from very easy questions to very hard questions. And you learn a trust level that lets you share things that you wouldn't trust maybe talking. And it's that trust level that you gain on that weekend that makes it real special.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
I think men need to learn to bring out the woman in themselves.
Oh.
You want to talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I guess historically, women have been the sort of like the emotional entity in a lot of relationships in terms of tending to the emotional side of the couple. And men never get to develop that to the potential that I think we probably have. And we're trapped. We get to a certain point and we're trapped. And women are spending all this energy, in a lot of cases, giving away more than they can afford emotionally and getting ripped off, maybe, and men are just sort of allowed to continue on. Well, that has a real draining effect on a relationship. And women are I think we've all got it, as men, I think we all have that ability in us to be tender, to get through denial and learn to not be shut down about our feelings. I guess I'm using a lot of lingo, but mm-hmm. It's sort of there. But and that, to me, is bringing out the woman in myself. The tenderness, the gentleness, the ability, the desire to feel, and to meet my partner halfway.
The sociologists who study the history of the family in particular and cross-culturally say that societies which very clearly separate the roles of males and females for their adult work experience, for the relationships that they should have as adults, tend to make this kind of demarcation. It's not always the same as what has been true very much in our culture, but emotional roles are separate just like everyday kind of roles are. And the problem is that a man who shows any of the behavior which is supposed to be for the female in his society is threatened by that, and vice versa. So that even individuals who would have natural tendencies in the opposite direction from their sex role in the society find that they have to force themselves to be what they aren't to fit that overall pattern. And in North America, there has been, it hasn't been as clearly demarcated as in many cultures, but there has been this kind of separation made historically, that in general men should have the outside work roles, and in the home should be the instrumental person, the one who accomplishes things and so on, and the woman should have the in the house role, which also leads to her being the keeper of the emotional part of the relationship. And in periods in our history where those roles are supposedly very clear cut, it is threatening to try to cross over. We are now coming into an era in which we're seeing much more blurring of roles. 42% of all households now are dual work outside the home kind of relationships. So as we change some of the expectations we have of our outside roles, we can also experiment with changing some of the inside roles changing. And so what this man just said fits into that we really have more freedom to try to share those kinds of emotional characteristics. I didn't mean to say that much. Somebody else wanted to say something for you.
What you're saying, combined with what you were saying, the male's ability to reach a feeling sensitivity level will continue to lag behind the ability to accept the vocation crossing over that is occurring. Because at least in our society, we still have a strong, using the popular expression, macho image of the male, which tends to de-emphasize that sensitivity, that feeling level. I could do sit through a counseling session and or a conversation, listen to how a man and a woman will respond to a sensitive issue. It's usually, I think, I feel. And seldom will, in general, you can just about put the man in the I think role and the woman in the I feel role.
Last week, one of the sessions that we had dealt with the, two sets of theories. One was the social thinker George Herbert Mead, who explains how it is that we come to accept, to internalize the roles that are laid before us in society, and all of the learning that we do. And that was coupled with the theories very recently of Carol Gilligan, a psychologist, who talks about the emotional and psychological development of males and females. And Gilligan stresses the fact that boys from very early on are learning all sorts of skills about cooperation and competition and so on. They're very active, and that seems to be natural in our society for boys to be that way, whereas girls are learning from very early on to solve emotional problems. Boys are solving physical problems. She says, what do 10, 11, 12-year-old girls do most of the time? What do they do? Talk.
Pretend. They talk.
Yes. They pretend and they talk and they try to figure out what's going on in relationships with people. whereas boys 10, 11, 12 are very busy doing things.
No, I think that all of us learn about marriage basically in the family that we grew up in. And perhaps, you know, a lot of the problems that arise in a marriage are because that the instruction you received in your own family as to what a marriage was all about, and what's the role of the father, what's the role of the mother, and how does the father relate to the mother, for example, and be considered a parent, and vice versa. The role models that you receive as a child may be all fouled up, quite frankly. And I think that as more and more of our families, for example, turn out to be single-parent families, you know, where are the children of today in those single-parent families going to learn about the proper relationship and loving exchange that can go on between a man and a woman in marriage at all? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they'll get married, and oftentimes, they'll have to start learning after they get married about what marriage is all about, truly about that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that's going to lead to, quite frankly, except a lot more people getting divorces and not working out the problems within the marriage, as a matter of fact.
One of the sessions that I thought about doing this week, which I decided not to do, partly because the people last week didn't vote for it, was called Parenting, the Hardest Job You'll Never Learn. And I think being a spouse is maybe the second hardest job you never learn. We learn about it, but we have to keep learning it all the time as we go along. I think it's got a couple more minutes on it. What did you want to say next?
Well, I was going to kind of give a counterpoint to his point about single parent situation. Maybe there's some advantages to that, because if you have a family, so-called family, that sticks together and everybody's miserable and they don't get a divorce, and what kind of, it's a terrible relationship both ways, we're packing around a lot of baggage. Maybe some people come out of single-parent families will have an advantage, because maybe they won't have seen a lot of bad behavior. Maybe they won't have a whole lot of stuff to unlearn. That's a possibility. I don't know. I'm not a social scientist. I don't know how to test that out, but just a kind of counterpoint.
Okay. I thought I saw someone else someplace around here wanted to say something a bit ago. Yes.
I'm just thinking about relationships before marriage, not sexual type relationships, but really getting to know people. I think a lot of times these days, people get married very quickly without knowing each other. Mm-hmm. Women tend to look at men, and this is a generalization, but women do oftentimes look at men and see something wonderful in a man, and are often living their lives for what they've seen in a man. Mm-hmm. And when they get married, find out that what they thought was there isn't there, and so they haven't gotten to know that person and haven't known what it is really that they want. And I think that's one of the problems.
Or they get 5-6 years down the road of marriage life, and it gets boring, and they say,
two children later.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people marry their own fantasies rather than the real other person.
I know that Jennifer James says that you have to start looking for someone that likes you, but if you find someone that likes you, you think they're pretty dorky because you don't like yourself. So you can't fall in love with someone that likes you, but fall in someone that doesn't like you that you beat your tail off to go after. I didn't even think about that for a minute. Mm-hmm. Especially boys in high school. I mean, when you're dating in high school, the guy that liked you, you didn't give the time of day to.
Mm-hmm. Well, what can we do for our children in trying to come to terms with all these issues of love, sex, marriage, etc.? You know, the word that we get as parents, are any of my kids here? Good. we're told as parents, those of us who are parents, that we should explain the facts of life to our children gradually, so that it is a kind of a natural thing, and answer their questions. I had one kid who never asked any questions and really didn't want to talk about this at all, did not want to hear anything. she was to go on a Girl Scout overnight when she was about 9. That wasn't Girl Scout yet. I guess it was Brownies. And the piece of paper that she brought home for me to sign for permission had a whole lot of things on it, including, it said on there, "Does your daughter understand menstruation so that if it happens to someone else while she's there, she won't be upset or scared or concerned about it?" So I thought, oh, perfect time. I kind of told her little bits and pieces, but I thought, this is a good time. I gave her the piece of paper and I said, "Do you know what this word means?" And she said, "No." So I started to tell her about it. And her reaction was, "Blood! Oh! Oh! Oh!" tends to block communication there, you know. She really didn't want to know anything about it. And she has always been very private about that aspect. We don't have mother-daughter talks about that. I initiate them from time to time, but it's not something that, you know, we communicate about. So I give her books to read, or I did, you know, long ago. One of my other children told me, frankly, "Mother, I know all about that." Well, we talked about it a little more because I'm sure that some of the information that that child had was not accurate. But it's not as easy. I mean, the theory says tell your children about it. It's not as easy. It reminds me of a story. I can't remember. Some comedian told this. Maybe you're familiar with it. A little girl came home and she said, "Mom, where do I come from?" So her mother started telling her various bits and pieces of that kind of information, and then the little girl said at the end of it, "Oh, okay. I was just wondering because Jennifer down the street says she comes from Pittsburgh." It's one thing even to talk about the factual aspects of these things, but to talk about the emotional, psychological, ethical, and so on, incorporate all that into it. It's not very easy. Yes?
My wife and I gave a sex information talk one evening with four other couples. Matter of fact, a whole day to share with the group the things that we came out of it. We talked about everything and anything from all the perspectives that you're asking. And many of the people were very curious how would we even start that type of a presentation. And we just went right into it. Said, they expected it, we wouldn't mince any words, and their jaws dropped. But we found out afterwards, in evaluating, that there were a lot of things that both men and women in there, who've been married 15 or 20 years, or even longer, knew nothing about the biological drives of both male and female. And one of the comments was like, the woman said, "My God, I thought I'd marry a sex maniac first week we were married. And the marriage is going to be like that the rest of the time. I want a divorce because of her family. I have the role playing her mother and parents that have many things you're talking about. The difference between the biological drive and role playing, and we went into that pretty intense. Where we get our masks, some of you talked about, and how do we fulfill those masks without exposing our needs and feelings behind some of those needs. It was interesting to find out most people of the age group, I think, in here, is a mixed age group. And many of the people had more questions afterwards, and we were not experts. We had created our own outline and read a few books. Yes, it did.
What sort of group was this? How did this happen?
Well, like the lady said, it was a marriage encounter group. And we were very open with each other to begin with. And my wife and I did, we had one marriage and family, and we had marriage in the early years of marriage, and sexual part before marriage. I had that, it was kind of embarrassing, but I laid everything on the line, you know, the stocking nail, you know, out there, like the female. This is love, remember, okay. We went through a lot of those, and then we had other people who talked about specifically the physiological development as your chart indicates, pretty much. It follows some of that flow. And then we went into roles of parents in India, and also the position of the church. There was a church, it was in the church, it was a God's name. We had a lot of fun. Anybody can set those things up, but you'd be surprised if you do a little research on it. There's a lot of information.
Yeah, that sounds like a very worthwhile kind of experience for a lot of people. Yes?
You were talking about talking to your daughter. Reminds me, we have two boys, 8 and 9. And, of course, we had talked to them in bits and pieces about sexuality. And then at about age 8 and 9, we wanted to get into it a little bit more deeply. And so I went to our church library, and there was a film strip and a record geared for their age. And of course I introduced it and talked about how it was a God-given gift and so forth. And with the two boys, knowing them, I said, and you ought to be old enough now not to laugh when you see some pictures that you haven't seen before. And so we're all set. And I turned the record player on, and I have on 78 instead of 33. So that was the end of the picture.
Yes.
I will add one more thing that Joe was talking about. I have three daughters, and my wife had done most of the preliminary sex talk to them. And we had decided after that weekend to be very open. And so they said, have you ever talked to your daughters about sex? And I said, yeah, and they said, why don't you? So that became a challenge. I did. I took them on a camping trip without my wife. And we talked around the campfire. And I tell you, my kids today, they really enjoy it from the male aspect. My wife took care of everything else. That was a really super experience for us. Because they cherish today, you know, they're 22 and they're adults. They always say that that was a highlight. And I said, gee, we sat around in marshmallows and talked about sex. And said, yeah.
I think what you were talking about, though, brings up a problem. If people have been married for 15, 20 years, as you were suggesting, and they have questions or they have problems with sexual relations, what are they telling their kids?
Right. That's what I, after our presentation, I decided I better talk to my kids.
Yeah.
So my kids, I think, are ahead. Because we made that, we feel proud of that, and our kids are. I agree with you. I feel sorry for some of the kids. Because where are the parents coming from? Mm-hmm. They've got some misconceptions themselves.
And it's hard to admit that.
and it all goes back to trust.
The teenage pressures aren't any... they aren't decreasing any in school today.
Peer pressure is another pressure for kids, yes.
You wanted to say
something? Well, I was just, not only from an emotional point of view, but from a physiologic point of view, when we went to our childbirth preparation classes, there were people literally sitting on their edge of the chair because it was the first time these 7-month pregnant women had seen these physiologic drawings of what was happening, not only to them now, but what their bodies were all about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with men, physically, things are a lot more visible, and they have much better idea of what their sexual organs are all about. Women are just really, a lot of women are.
Yeah, I think that that part of it is because of what you're saying, the male organs are external. All babies explore their bodies. Little boys have something to hang on to, and girls don't, and so they don't tend to focus in the same way from infancy onward in knowing what their bodies are all about.
But I was truly astounded to look around this room of pregnant people and realized that so many women just had, they knew they were going to have a baby, and obviously they were trying to learn about that because they were in this class, but it really, really was new information for them.
Right, and again, the mixed message is it's the most natural thing in the world to have a baby, right? But wrong, it isn't. and women, historically in our culture, have not been encouraged to really get too much information in this area because, the more you know, the more you might want to fool around. Somebody over here. Yeah.
I'd like to have the audience respond to my question of what should we in the schools be doing to deal with the youngsters and at what age?
What the school board says you can do.
Huh. parents like to see me happening. What would you see as the ideal world?
Take the contraceptives out of high school clinics, for one thing.
Out?
Yes.
Why?
I don't. And you're just encouraging them to go out and have more sex.
I think some just babies prove that.
Yes. That's right. I think that would probably work.
They're going to do without contraceptives.
They're
going
to have children. Right. I don't know how easy it is.
I'm a teacher that is really trying in a program where I'm on a steering committee and I'm in an elementary school of giving the teachers some training with counselors on how to deal with one thing about loss and dealing with loss of loved ones as well as divorce and about their sexual being. And this is not the nurse coming in the 1 hour in the fourth or fifth grade and showing the film. I think that it's going to have to be in a much more trust level, and I think teachers see the kids more than their parents do these days. And the training has to be given to the teachers so that they can do this. And I think the parents should, we should have parent meetings at night and have parents come. And the information, like Luke was talking about, have some professionals in there that those parents can trust, that they can believe, to give them this information. I think we have to share that.
Because if the parents aren't involved, the kid will go home and what he learned in school will just be shot down immediately.
You need to get the parents. You need to get the parents involved. As a part of the money in this merge program is to get these parent meetings going. I don't know if we'll get the right parents there, but we're trying to get the parents so that they can learn to parent better.
Yeah.
I'd like to have the gentleman who advocates taking contraceptives out of the schools expound on that a little bit.
Sure. I think we should be telling our children that premarital sex is wrong, and I don't think you can with a straight face tell them that premarital sex is wrong and then provide them with contraceptives.
That's news to me that schools are providing contraceptives.
There are some schools that have gotten some publicity in recent months, even, that have clinics affiliated with.
And they don't have to inform the parents about that either.
They're primarily, the ones that I've read about are primarily inner city large public schools that have health clinics affiliated with them.
We have to inform the parents and that the youngsters won't come to get the contraceptives.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is really a very debatable issue that will continue to be so in our society, I think. You wanted to say one other thing?
Well, I think there's some comparisons that can be drawn to drinking or drug use. I mean, underage drinking is against the law, and we might say it's wrong to drink when you're underage. But that doesn't stop people from drinking underage.
That's correct.
Nor does it stop people from having sex.
That's
just
correct.
Just because we tell them it's wrong. So what I'm trying to say is, let's acknowledge that it's going to go on, and then let's not try to pull the blinders over our eyes and pretend that the problem isn't there. We're not really giving permission, but let's look at reality. And
I think
say,
you
what
are.
What do we want to do? You know, let's help people be good contraceptives if they're going to do it, or if they're going to go and drink. I mean, people need to know something about the effects of alcohol and the possibilities of alcoholism if they're going to drink. It's just, we can't turn back the clock. And I think that's what you'd like to see happen. And that's not a reality.
Here?
I think that's a moral issue. And I don't know. I wonder if that should be something between the individual parents and their individual children. And, I mean, I think that's probably a moral religious issue. And if I'm not a parent, but if I, as a parent, didn't want my kids to think that premarital sex was the right thing, then I think that would be my responsibility with my kids and trust them morally to make that decision. Mm-hmm. And if somebody else is raising their kids differently, then I think that I don't think I have to.
And do you think that you would be able to say to your kid, assuming you have one, that I as your parent don't think that premarital sex is right, and I don't think you should do it either? And do you think that those words would actually say to that kid, I'm not ever going to do it until I get married?
Well, I don't know, but I know that I know that a lot of kids don't take drugs, and drugs are available.
Sure.
And a lot of kids
don't swear.
Yeah, don't swear.
That's
very nice for your children if you're ready to educate them. But there are an awful lot of people out there who say nothing to their children. And they're out there leading them. And they're the ones that perhaps should definitely have some education in school or by someone else.
We have about one more minute, and you've been wanting to say something.
Well, I think it just brings up the importance, stresses it even more, how important it is, the sex education in the public schools with the parents' involvement. And I don't really know what to say about, you know, the contraceptives in the schools. I really don't, but it is a very big dilemma. And just from my own personal experience as a nurse working in a maternity ward, seeing the 14 and 15 year olds coming through there every week, you know, I mean, they were always there having babies. And I tell you, it really hurt me to walk into a room and see those little girls with those babies, and they were so frightened, so immature. It is a dilemma.
It is a serious social problem that we have right now. And it's of sociological interest that the baby boom among children comes at precisely the time that we have so much information available about contraception. So it's like it's happening in spite of the fact that there are now things that can be done about it.